This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. You've heard it since you were old enough to remember. Be good. And there are plenty of enforcers. Parents, priests, and police all have their systems of rewards and punishments. Supposedly, they're appealing to our innate sense of right and wrong. But if we all know that right is good and wrong is bad, why all the manipulation? Ruth Grant has thought a lot about the subject. Her most recent book is called Strings Attached, Untangling the Ethics of Incentives. Ruth Grant is a professor of political science and philosophy at Duke University and a senior fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics, and she joins us now in the studio. Ruth, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here today.
What got you thinking about incentives?
Well, I think that it had been in the back of my mind for quite a long time because incentives are everywhere around us, and incentives in child rearing particularly had been something I'd been thinking about. But there was a triggering event in a class that I was teaching at Duke where I was teaching a Greek tragedy called the Philoctetes. And in the opening scene of that play, Odysseus is trying to get a young nobleman to do something deceitful to get something from somebody. And the young man says he'd rather get it in a fair fight. So the class was discussing whether sometimes force might actually be ethically superior to certain forms of persuasion. And then one student raised his hand and said, why don't they just offer him an incentive to get it? And that was a kind of aha moment for me that, first of all, that we always think about incentives and the Greeks never did, but mostly the idea that incentives are a form of power, just like coercion and persuasion, and that we ought to think about the ethics of their use in the same way that we think about the use and abuse of other forms of power.
And I guess in the largest sense, the threat of force is an incentive of some kind. I mean, in the sense that you have a choice here, right, to either accept my offer or take the rather.
Right, but if you're really worse off, whichever choice you make, that's a real threat. And
well, that's a key point, and it's a point that you make in the book. Let's talk about that. The where you are in the picture before and after you accept the incentive makes a big difference on how we view these things, whether you're worse off. Talk about that.
Right. Well, if somebody puts a gun at your head and says your money or your life, whether you give them your money or you give them your life, you're worse off in either case. So that's a classic threat, and we would call that coercion. But if I offer you $100 to participate in a medical study, and you can take it or leave it, and whichever you do, you're not worse off than you were before. So that's a genuine offer.
And do we think about the sort of larger questions of good and evil, about what we're trying to achieve with incentives? In other words, if we offer an incentive, there's an assumption that we're up to something good. That's why we're doing this. Is that right?
Well, the person offering the incentive wants to get the other person to do what they want them to do. And sometimes that's a morally good thing, but sometimes it's just a practical thing, like come to work or put in extra hours on the job or something like that.
So you said that you had this epiphany teaching about the Greeks and Greek literature, and you just made the comment, well, we've figured out incentives. Apparently the Greeks hadn't. So how far back does this idea of incentives go?
Well, I'm sure that people actually used incentives always. But the idea of incentives and the language of incentives is much more recent than you would think. It was much more recent than I thought. When I started this project, the first thing I did is I went to the Oxford English Dictionary, and I thought I was going to find lots of uses of incentives in the 18th century when the idea of the free market was born with Adam Smith and other writers like him. And the surprising thing is you don't find that language there. It comes into play in America in the early part of the 20th century with scientific management and industry. A man named Frederick Taylor was a big figure in that movement. And it was also conjoined with the birth of behavioral psychology at around about the same time, with the idea in both cases being that people, like other creatures, adapt to their environment. And if you can control their environment by using incentives, you can get them to do what you want them to do. Incentives were understood as a tool of social engineering in that context, and it's a really clear new idea at that time.
And it has to do with, as you suggest, our different understanding about what is at the root of human motivation, rather than any change in ethics.
Right, right. except I think that that idea about motivation has ethical implications, and that's a big part of what I'm trying to say in the book. So, for example, we have a very recent new word called incentivize. We've turned it into a verb, right? But if you ask, how can I incentivize somebody to do something, instead of asking, how can I motivate them to do something, your answer is going to be some kind of incentive. But motivation is a much broader category. You can be motivated to do something by curiosity, by a role model, by a sense of responsibility, by all kinds of things other than simply a benefit to yourself.
So let's take some of the examples that you use in the book, and you talk about the way we use incentives in school to get students to do certain things. Tell us about the importance of that and what you learned.
Well, one of the things I learned is that we've actually known quite a lot about this for maybe 50 years. There's been research on using incentives to motivate kids to learn. And what you find is that they can work for very simple, direct tasks like attendance. If you want to improve attendance, incentives can sometimes help. If you want to teach kids to read better or to write better or anything that really involves a lot of complex thought, they're much less likely to work well. It matters a lot what the incentive is. If right now there are programs where people are experimenting with giving cold hard cash for grades. Other kinds of programs that offer scholarships send a different message. You know, if the incentive is a scholarship, the message is education is important, and that's the thing we really want you to care about. If the incentive is cash, the message might be, this isn't worth doing unless somebody compensates you for it.
But isn't there always an incentive? I mean, anytime you defer gratification, you go to school instead of play ball. There must be some incentive. There must be some reason. And we thought the reason is, well, you'll do much better. You'll get a good job and lots of money later on. People will like you more. Go to school.
Yeah, those are all possible reasons for doing a certain thing. But I resist using the incentive as an umbrella concept to cover every reason for doing something.
How would you distinguish those?
Some reasons for doing something are intrinsic to the activity itself. It won't, you know, if you're sick and I tell you if you go to the doctor, you're likely to get better, that's a good reason to go to the doctor. It's intrinsic to what will happen when you go there. If I say, if you go to the doctor, I'll take you out to dinner, that's entirely extrinsic to the situation. It's something I add to the situation in order to get you to do something because you don't appreciate the real reasons to do it or those aren't strong enough.
And then, of course, the ethical debate is whether or not you should be doing things for the wrong reason, even though it might be good for you.
Yeah, and there I think, like with many of these things, it's the context that matters entirely. And if we could go back to the example of using incentives in education, it might be fine to do things for, quote, the wrong reason initially, but you would want any incentive program to eventually produce students who have at least some love of learning or appreciation of satisfying their curiosity.
Plea bargaining is an example where things get a little more gray, and you talk extensively about that.
Yeah. Plea bargaining is a situation where many people, well, they see the situation as a bargain, like any other kind of trade or exchange. The prosecutor and the defendant both feel that they're better off as a result of the bargain, and so there's no ethical problem with it as long as you can show that the defendant is really acting voluntarily. Voluntariness is the only criterion. And I try to say that it suggests that it's not, and here's where the power analysis comes in. The question that I ask is whether the offer is an offer that ought to be being made by the state in this situation. And if you think that the purposes of the criminal justice system are to discover the truth and to punish people according to their merits, and you think about a plea bargaining situation, what happens is that neither of those values is served. Either an innocent person pleads guilty or a guilty person gets less than they purportedly deserve.
Unless you assume that because you've saved the state the time and energy and expense of taking you to a trial and you've come clean, which is a suggestion that perhaps you're beginning to repent, then we should indeed reduce the penalty.
I still think that it's true that there's an efficiency aspect to this that we need to consider, but we should at least appreciate that we're trading off efficiency on the one hand against some very deeply problematic ethical issues on the other.
And I think getting back to the power equation here, because of the asymmetries involved in the rules of discovery, I don't want to get too technical, but it turns out that the defendant isn't always making the best choice in their case.
And the defendant is often really – this is a situation where it's hard to tell the difference between an offer and a threat, because if the prosecutor says – you know, I'll let you off if you agree, and if you don't, I'll throw the book at you. then the offer is a threat.
It's like the protection racket. I think I can protect this place from being firebombed if you pay me $100 a week. That's pretty clear. And also, you point out that judges often understand that a plea bargain has been tendered, and if you refuse, they don't look kindly on that.
There are judges who are more severe in those situations.
I want to talk more about this because there are certainly other examples of places where we use incentives and the notion of good and evil become distorted. But then that raises the whole question, the heck are we talking about when we talk about good and evil? All of that. We will continue on the state of things. Ruth Grant is with us, a professor of political science and philosophy at Duke and the author of Strings Attached, Untangling the Ethics of Incentives. Sam Wells, the Duke Dean of Chapel at Duke Divinity at Duke University and teaches in the Divinity School, will be with us. And we're going to take your phone calls and emails. 877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation for better and worse on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and today we're talking about nothing less than good and evil. What are they? How do we know what is good and what is evil? Are they absolute? Are they relative? Ruth Grant is with us. She's a professor of political science and philosophy at Duke University and a senior fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics. Her most recent book is called Strings Attached, Untangling the Ethics of Incentives. And joining us now is Sam Wells. He is the dean of Duke University Chapel and a research professor of Christian ethics at Duke's Divinity School. Welcome, Sam. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank.
Taking your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. We're talking about incentives, whether or not they really do what they're meant to do. Certainly they can manipulate us, change behavior, but do they ultimately get at something good? And we can take your calls on that, 877-962-9862. But Sam, we're talking about incentives and how they influence behavior. I guess that we really have to get back to the ultimate question of whether or not we know what it is to be good. Where does that idea come from? Is there an essential quality of good that we have a right then to incentivize to get you to do it?
It's a very controversial issue in the history of philosophy and the history of human civilization. For Christians, the notion of good is always tied up with the notion of God. But clearly that's not the case for everybody. And once you disentangle the two, obviously the notion of good can become very complex.
And is that, I mean, you know, if we get back to the beginning in the Bible, at the point in the Bible where it was a book for Muslims, Christians, and Jews, the story of Adam and Eve, banished from the garden because they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It was precisely that distinction that got them kicked out, wasn't it?
Well, I find very helpful Augustine's description of the fall, where he talks about the fact that after the fall, we retain the ability to make choices, but we lose the ability to discern what a good choice is. And I think that's a helpful, very contemporary description of where we stand now.
Well, Ruth, what about the use of incentives? Does it bear, do we need to get this deep into the question of knowing what is essentially good and evil before we begin to design a system of incentives?
Well, incentives are sometimes used to induce people to act well, but it seems to me that's almost the least of what it is to be good, with it's only some small part of what it is to be good. That very often the capacity that we really need is a capacity for judgment, which is suggested a little bit by Sam's remark as well. And incentives give people choices, but they don't really create a situation where a person is asked to judge the case on the merits.
Even a judgment requires some sense of a template, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's where I think people need to focus their energies in a way, thinking about the various things we mean when we say that something is good. Or we know that lots of things are good. Being a good friend is good. Being kind is good. holding up your responsibilities is good. All of these things are. But they sometimes come in conflict with one another, and you don't always know what they mean in the situation. And there has to be some kind of capacity to sort those things out.
Capacity and some kind of, again, objective model against which we can make the judgment. This is the good, and everything needs to be judged against that. I will quote no less a figure than Satan himself in Paradise Lost, who said, you know, the human mind has the capacity to make a hell of heaven and a heaven of hell. We do tend to get things turned around when we are the ones who define what is good and what is evil, when it's left to us. Well, let's take an example. Let's take an example of something very good that's considered pretty good. The IMF makes loans, and they help nations develop their economies. This is the concept behind IMF. And you take this on in your book, Ruth, the idea of these incentives that are attached to the loans that are designed, we think, to help countries improve their economies.
Well, the loan conditions from the IMF, everybody seems to understand, have a limit on what they can be. That the IMF has certain legitimate purposes attached to improving the country's economy so that they can pay back their loans. But there's been a kind of mission creep over the years where the IMF figures that they ought to be looking at the long-term economic health of the country, and then almost anything goes as a condition that can contribute to that. It's very hard to know how to draw the line.
Well, and its critics will argue that their ultimate goal is not to develop those countries so much as to develop the wealth of the countries that are helping them out. And so those Western nations that need markets would like somebody to make the infrastructure to get their stuff in and out so that they can continue to get ever richer. And that's the cynical view of what would be, you know, ostensibly a kind of a nice thing to do. It seems to be borne out more and more. And in any case, it's worth questioning. All right, so we've quoted Satan, and now I think the only other authority we should go to is the TV show Friends, which is ultimately, I think, the source of knowledge and wisdom for all of us, and one a source of great theological comfort to us. But here the nature of good and bad and sort of what we really mean when we try to do something right is deeply explored. Let's listen.
I'm sorry, Phoebes. I just wanted to do a good deed, like you did with the babies.
This isn't a good deed. You just want to get on TV. This is totally selfish.
Whoa. What about you having those babies for your brother? Talk about selfish.
What are you talking about?
Well, yeah, it was a really nice thing and all, but it made you feel really good, right?
Yeah, so?
Well, it made you feel good, so that makes it selfish. Look, there's no unselfish good deeds. Sorry.
Yes, there are. There are totally good deeds that are selfless.
Well, may I ask for one example?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's... No, you may not.
So, Sam Wells, do we need to inspect our motives before we do a deed and before we dare call it good?
I asked this question to a monk when I was 22 years old. I'd just left college, and I was idealistic, as I still am, I hasten to add. And I was struggling with the fact that I was very aware of my own shortcomings. And I realized that at that stage I was living on a very low income in a very poor part of the country in England, in Liverpool. And I felt I wasn't doing it for the right reasons, rather like your friends on Friends. I was doing it to feel good about myself and, you know, all that kind of thing. I said to this monk, you know, help me with this. And he said some words I've never forgotten. Stayed with me for the rest of my life. He said, you know, we do things for half a dozen or a dozen reasons, and if one of those reasons is good, then God can use that. But if you wait for all of them to be good, you're going to stay on your backside for a very long time.
Is that the rule that governs the creation of incentives, Ruth? The sense
that just seems like very good advice.
Yeah.
Just to address the Friends question directly, when people get satisfaction out of doing good things, you could call that selfish, but it doesn't seem to me to be a bad thing. I would like to live in a world where people took satisfaction in doing good things.
I mean, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say this is the point of the Friends clip is something that I get from students very, very often. They're very, very concerned that they, as Sam says he was at that around that age, that what they're doing is somehow really selfish and therefore they need to condemn themselves for it. And I think they should be easier on themselves as long as there's a generous impulse behind their action.
But at the so that's what we can do at the personal level. But then when we create incentives, either in the tax code or there's a program that, you know, incentivizes kids to stay in school, again, are we looking at people who would just love to see the dropout rate lower? And that just can make everybody feel a lot better. And maybe not does it become a problem when you enable a system to go on not being healthy because you get the numbers up. Our incentive, oh, we got 30% of the dropout rate was reduced because of this program. We're feeling pretty good about that. You never asked, why were so many kids dropping out? Must be something wrong with your system. Nobody had to ask that question.
Well, I think you do have to ask that question. And one of the things about incentives is that they always imply that the problem is a problem of motivation. And that's not always what the problem is. You know, if you give teachers incentives to improve their kids' reading scores, that implies that the problem is that the teachers aren't working hard enough. And that may not be the problem at all.
Let's go to the phones. Andrew is on the line from Durham. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good. Well, I just first wanted to say that if you incentivize people to do good, then that means that first off, you have to have somebody in power to decide what is good. And then second off, if you depend on incentives only, then eventually the situation is going to evolve and you're going to have people depending on only incentives instead of actually the good deed.
How about that? Sam? Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, I think behind this is a notion of altruism, which I think is problematic. Altruism posits a zero-sum game where everything that I'm doing that I get some benefit of from is somehow taking away from you. And I think Ruth is describing a much more humane situation where there's lots of good to be had out there, and we can all enjoy it at the same time. It doesn't have to be a scarcity economy where my benefit takes away from yours. As far as the power question is concerned, I'm not too concerned about the power for one person to dictate what is good, because good is an ongoing conversation amongst people, and they will have different power relations. But it's never a settled matter. But there's also power involved in the giving of incentives. You have to have the resources at your disposal to make those, you know, make those incentives mm-hmm. available. So, again, I think it's a little bit naive to suggest that you can take power out of this in some way. What Ruth, I think, is pointing to that I feel is most important is the development of character, because character is that which gives you an internal power that enables you to discern between when you're being bribed and when you're being encouraged.
But I think it's central to Andrew's question is, if you're bribing me from a very early age, how will I develop that character?
Well, we all mix in more than one community. We write poems if we're middle-aged British poets. We write poems about how our parents have destroyed our lives. But then we have opportunities in other parts of our lives to be redeemed by other relationships that we make. So I think it's also, I think everybody listening to the program will know people who've grown up in very challenging circumstances and somehow amazingly have emerged out of those circumstances with remarkably gracious characters, and people who've grown up in very positive circumstances and seem to have gone in the other direction. So I don't think it's as simple as simply to say we've been fed these things. This notion that we are what we eat is oversimplified. Clearly, we are what we eat, but we're also a lot of other things as well as what we eat.
Doesn't it suggest, too, though, if these things are essentially good for us, if we're creating incentives for people to do the right thing, the ultimate question is, why do they need incentives? What is it about the right thing that is so unclear to those individuals that some other authority has to come in and say, here's something you didn't know, here's a buck, go find out? I mean, doesn't that point to aren't we it's almost the same question. Aren't we enabling them? But the real question is, why can't we? Why can't we see what's good for ourselves on our own?
Well,
shouldn't we be able to do that?
Very often people can, and they get insulted when they're offered incentives. There's a large literature now on the situations where incentives backfire, and one of them is exactly the kind of situation you're talking about. There was a study done of blood donors in England where the women particularly were much less likely to, quote, donate blood if they were offered money to do it, because they took that as a kind of insult, that they're rather than appreciating their generous impulse.
But again, that's sort of based on Sam's notion of the misguided sense of altruism, that if I really mean good by this, I shouldn't accept anything, and not trusting the fact that, look, you said yes to this proposition to donate, to help. Well, it shows up in other places, too. We talked about international aid. An outspoken critic of international and Western aid to Africa is a Zambian writer, Dembiza Moyo. She's the author of Dead Aid, a book that is highly critical of Western aid, even when it comes to AIDS abatement in Africa. She was on an interview show recently and asked again about President Bush's program. It's been continued in the Obama administration, $30 billion over 5 years to help bring AIDS medicine to Africa, which we know is in desperate need. It's called the, and I think you'll hear a reference to it, the PEPFAR program. And Dembiza Moyo is not persuaded it's a good idea.
We're skirting over a very, very fundamental point. And this is precisely why I say the aid model is couched in the sense that Africans are not capable of doing it themselves.
All right.
The point is, healthcare, education, infrastructure, and even security are public goods. They are goods that the governments of Africa are supposed to be providing to their people. The reason why Americans go and vote between John McCain and President Obama is because you decide, as Americans, who you think is best going to be equipped to provide public goods. We are looking for that right also in Africa. And equipped with that, a friend of mine from Africa said, well, if it's actually going to be a situation where we are African governments are not providing these goods, why do we bother electing them? Why should we not be electing the PEPFAR program versus the British AIDS program? Because they're the ones who are ultimately providing public goods. The reality is the PEPFAR programs are unsustainable. America's facing 10% unemployment rate. We're in the middle
so
of a credit crisis.
From the point of view of Africa, I want to make sure I've got this.
Sure.
You're suggesting that even PEPFAR, even the AIDS program, if permitted to remain in place, would prove insidious.
It's precisely the point.
So her point, you're infantilizing. This is a paternalistic program. It may make you feel good, but ultimately it's doing more harm than good. Even if in the process lives are saved that would ultimately be lost while we're waiting for our leadership to rise.
I think the point is slightly different as far as this program is concerned, and the very outspoken person that you brought into the conversation there. I think I would agree with her that redemption is usually comes from within communities themselves if it's going to be sustainable, there isn't a technological solution. You know, technological solutions are usually ways of trying to make a better world without us needing to become better people. And this program is a version of that. It's an attempt to bring resources into the situation when resources aren't the real issue. The real issue is the people finding the moral courage, finding the strength within their own community to make the kind of government which will give them what they need. And it's difficult to the person with a hammer in their pocket. Everything looks like a nail. America has extensive medical resources. It sees people suffering in Africa, and it assumes that what it has in its pocket is the answer to the problem. So I think that's an aspect of psychology. I think it's a slightly different one to the one that we've been on up to now.
Well, but to the extent that people are trying to do good, and here's a critic saying, I think you're actually doing more harm than good, even though ostensibly how could anyone argue that saving people from a horrible and early death could ever be bad? And she's saying it is, and it's paternalistic, and I bet you wouldn't do it. If the problem was in Sweden, you'd wait to be asked, or you'd wait for a different set of circumstances before you just went in to that country where everybody looked a little more like you. And that's, I think, also at the center of her critique.
Well, maybe that's the case. But I think that it's also true that we would be subject to criticism for doing nothing and have been in the past on exactly the same grounds. You aren't helping us because we're not like you, and you could help us because you have the resources to prevent these deaths. So part of it is a matter of how you define the problem. Is the problem to prevent deaths or suffering from disease? Or is the problem a broader political and social problem of the kind that Sam suggests and the woman in the clip suggests of building a sustainable political community and recognizing the agency of the people in that country?
I should point out that Moyo has also said on many occasions that she's not at all critical of emergency aid. So when there's a tsunami, when there's an earthquake, then the idea of people rushing in to help is perfectly appropriate. It's these government-to-government programs and these huge aid programs that she objects to, just to make that distinction. On the program today, Ruth Grant, professor of political science and philosophy at Duke and a senior fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics, Sam Wells, dean of the Duke University Chapel and research professor of Christian ethics at Duke Divinity School. And just ahead, we're going to take more of your phone calls on good and evil and take a look at good and evil from a literary standpoint. Your phone calls 877-962-9862, SOTAWNC.org. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about the nature of good and evil. How can we identify good and distinguish it from evil? Are they absolute? Are they relative? Ruth Grant is with us, professor of political science and philosophy at Duke University, a senior fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics. Her most recent book, Strings Attached, Untangling the Ethics of Incentives. Also with us is Sam Wells. He's the dean of Duke University Chapel and a research professor of Christian ethics at Duke Divinity School. And joining us now is Katie Munger. She's a Durham-based mystery writer, and you may know her from the Hubert and Lill books, Casey Jones series, or her latest, The Dead Detective series. Katie, welcome back to the program.
Good evening. Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
Taking phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the nature of incentives, the essence of good and evil. Give us a call, 877-962-9862. Email address, sot@wunc.org. So, Katie, we've been talking about the sort of nature of good and evil. That's got to be the grist, right? That's got to be a foundation for writing a mystery. How do you approach this question in its essence when you begin to write a mystery?
Well, I mean, I would argue that all literature is a society trying to answer that question of what is good and what is evil, because certainly it changes according to our times. With me, all good and all evil comes down to people. Good lives in people. Evil lives in people. I actually see both as tangible forces, and I see evil as an independent force that lives outside of people as well. I think all people are born inherently good. And what's most interesting to me, though, is that they get diverted from the path of doing good by all the examples of self-interest we see, people profiting from incentives and self-interest and beyond just pure altruism. And I believe that as a writer, what I'm helping people do is sort of reassure themselves that they're good by seeing examples of it, by personifying the battle of good versus evil. The problem is good is often very quiet, especially if you're not getting any recognition for it or reward. And people want to be good. That to me is proof that people are inherently good, is that they want to see themselves as good. You'll take the most evil man on earth, and he can justify what he does in a way that makes him believe that he's actually doing good. So I think when I start out to write a book, I'm just trying to help people find themselves sort of in that progression from good to evil and eliminate some of their fears about evil. I think people fear evil taking over them. I think they fear that we will lose the battle of good versus evil. And in real life, when there are endless images of evil filtering in from all over the world, it is very easy to become ever more fearful that it will win.
What about that, Sam, that these are essential qualities, these are things, good and evil, that they reside in all of us, and that there is some tension between these forces, absolute forces?
I'm a little cautious about that. I think they're forms of description. I wouldn't describe them as entities in themselves, and they're to some extent in the eye of the beholder. I don't have a particular stake in good and evil. I have, as a Christian theologian, I have a particular stake in God. And my notion of good resembles my notion of God. Things are more good because they are more like God. And the less they're like God, the less good they are. So again, going back to Augustine, Augustine has the notion that, that evil doesn't really exist. It's non it's nonness. It doesn't have a purchase of its own. It doesn't have a resonance of its own.
But can there even be good if there isn't evil? What would be the sense? It would be a senseless concept, good, wouldn't it, without its opposite? There'd be
As I say, I mean, to me, that's a bit if you translate good into God, then you know that's a bit like saying, can there be God if there isn't an opposing force? Well, I think there can. You know, to me, God is the rationale of the universe. I, as a Christian theologian, understand that in a personal way. Others have a notion of a rationale of the universe, which isn't about personal interventions. I would still call that more or less their God. But evil is one of a number of forms of disorder. Christians refer to sin; they refer to evil. But I would also refer to things like collusion, which is where we find we're part of a system that we've gone along with. And the debate about incentives lies, I think, more there than in terms of evil and sin. But there's also a fourth thing that I would call something like lack of imagination, which is just like being late, you know, just not having an understanding of the effect of your actions on other people. And if you look at office politics, the rows are often because somebody is trying desperately hard not to call something sin and to call it lack of imagination, when actually it really is sin.
No, what do you mean? No, give us an example of that.
Well, when someone's late every single day for 2 weeks, you know, that's because they're just not have no regard for their co-workers. But we find it very difficult to go up to them and say, you're out of order. We sort of say, I appreciate, you know, maybe your watch isn't working, you know, mm-hmm. this kind of thing. These are lack of imagination things. But actually, the trouble about evil, collusion, and lack of imagination is, from a Christian point of view, if you don't translate them into sin, they can't be forgiven. They can't be redeemed. As I said, only sin can be redeemed. So evil needs to be broken to evil, whether it's the Holocaust, the genocide in Rwanda, or it needs to be broken down into whole individual acts of sin, and then those can be forgiven one by one by one, very slow process. But actually, that needs to happen for collusion and lack of imagination as well. And we've got strong resistances because we don't want to call them sin, because that seems like we're getting all heavy and saying somebody's, you know, been just terrible. But the trouble is, then we just build up mounds and mounds and mounds of resentment against
right.
them, until we call it what it is.
What about Ruth? The evil, good, are they things, or are they?
I actually wanted to pick up on something else that Katie said that I thought was very important, which is that people want to think of themselves as good. I think that's absolutely true, and a huge motivator for people to actually do good, but also one of the things that drives our tendency to rationalize when we do things that we kind of know really aren't so good, but we need that self-approval, so we come up with justifications. And I also, if you don't mind, I wanted to ask her a question as a writer, whether you find that the evil characters tend to be more interesting.
Yes, they are, because to me, everyone's a fallen angel. Everyone started out good and something made them veer from that path. And whether it's a backstory or actually in the story I'm telling at the time, how they came from good and ended up so evil is an interesting and fascinating story to me, and what I like to build my books around.
Well, I want to pursue that for another moment, too, and the idea that everybody wants to be good. They are fallen angels. Now, if we're an angel, perhaps we came from this place where the God that Sam refers to is, and there's an essential good and a model. On the other hand, wanting to be good might just be wanting to fit in, wanting not to seem bad to people. You could be good here in the South as a white person and support segregation, because that's what your church told you to do. That's what your neighbors do, and you needed to fit in. It was normal. And a good law-abiding citizen would raise his children to understand that this is what God wants. Now, that's wrong. And yet, you'd have yourself thoroughly convinced that it's right. It's not because it's right. It is wrong. And God said it was wrong. But it was normal. And you confused normal with an ultimate good, which would be not to discriminate against your brother. So how do you distinguish that? And as you're putting characters together when you write, I mean, is there a difference between simply wanting to fit in and be normal and somehow subscribing to something that's ultimately good.
Well, I think it probably just goes back to the question of what do we consider normal as a society. If our society accepted that we should all, as Spike Lee said, do the right thing, and accepted that we had within us sort of an innate ability to determine in any one situation what the right and wrong thing to do was. But in some ways, we're being told what's right. We're being sold things to do what's right. We look on reality TV and there are these incredibly wealthy people we're worshiping, and we're told that that's the right way to live. So basically, we're abdicating our responsibility, I think, as a society to really promote the values that lead to good. And of course, people are trying to fit in and be like everybody else. I'm just sorry, as a member of the society, that fitting in doesn't mean supporting our fellow citizens more.
You know, Ruth, you have talked about too much good being a bad thing in a sense. You find the story, The Giving Tree, kind of horrifying. Why?
Yes, that's a piece of literature that I use to talk about an ethical question. What happens in The Giving Tree is that there's a relationship between a tree who's described as female and a boy. And when the boy is young, they have a wonderful relationship with one another. And as the boy grows older, he keeps coming back and asking the tree for more and more, first for apples, then for limbs to build a house, and finally for the trunk of the tree to build a boat and sail away from her. And she says yes every time, even at the point of losing her whole substance and being left as nothing but a stump. At the end of the story, the boy comes back as an old man, and all he needs is a place to sit, so the fact that she's a stump turns out to be perfect. But I don't see this as a perfect story. It seems to me that a person can be too altruistic, too self-sacrificing, giving to the point of damaging to their own substance without doing any good in the world. The boy doesn't learn reciprocity through this. There's never any sign that he's made better by it or keeps up his part of the relationship. He's just, it could be the giving tree and the taking boy. So I thought that raised a lot of interesting questions. I think there are very few things that we think of as good, like altruism or loyalty or justice or whatever, that aren't in some circumstances maybe not so good, or that it's not possible to overdo these things in some way.
Sam, can we be too good?
The great commandment, as it's known, to love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength and love your neighbor as yourself, is really three commandments: to love God, to love your neighbor, and to love yourself. And again, my antagonism towards altruism is it somehow suggests that loving your neighbor is an emptying exercise that means you actually can't love yourself. It seems to me that heaven is a place where the love of God, of neighbor, and of self are in happy equilibrium. And I think Ruth's example of the giving tree is a very good one, because it shows that's a false picture of a love for another that involves no love for the self. And I think that's it's a romantic, in some ways idealistic notion of love, but I think it's fundamentally a false notion of love.
Katie, I wonder if you had a thought about that we can, and maybe what's behind that, a sense that maybe you want to be seen as a loving person, and that becomes
To me, that's what you're doing, is you are drawing your sense of self from other people. You need their approval, that you're such a good person, and you don't have that innate in you. It's interesting when you give yourself away to others. I think that good is a luxury. Good is a luxury that comes after you've been fed, and you can't be hungry, you can't be deprived, you have to have a place to live before you can think about doing good. And so when you give so much of yourself away to other people, in some ways you're chipping away at the foundation that allows you to open up and see those kinds of things. As an author, I can say that I find martyrs extremely annoying. They're predictable, and they've sort of abdicated their sense of self. So yeah. They don't have as much layering
yeah.
as others.
Yeah, they're melodramatic. They just wouldn't be plausible in a lot of ways if there's not a lot more density to it. Sam, you've talked about and written about, in a practical way, when we try to get our heads around this, we've talked about some difficult questions for which there are no answers. But you've talked about improvisation as being a way of managing ourselves, of using the skills and the techniques of improvisational actors in a way to negotiate this difficult territory of finding ourselves, the levels of giving, and the reasons for doing what we do.
Well, the central notion in improvisation is what's called over-accepting, which is a way of seeing everything that comes towards us as an offer, including an incentive, which is a particular kind of offer. And then we have three choices as how we respond to it. We can accept it and allow it to determine our actions and our character. We can block it and try to have nothing to do with it. Or we can over-accept it, that's to say fit it into a larger story. People often ask me questions about this and say, surely there are some things that must be blocked. But rather like the caller who called in a little while ago, I kind of want to come back and ask, well, what's the power you assume you have to be able to block Hitler or Stalin or whatever? You know, that means you've got all these battalions behind you. And so my argument is that faithfulness for Christians, certainly maybe for others, is that that we're constantly dealing with narratives. I think this does apply to Ruth's concerns about incentives. And we're evaluating the appropriateness of things that come our way by whether they fit into the larger story, not just our own story, but the story of which we perceive ourselves to be a part.
Well, while we're talking about the bad news is, Sam Wells, you are leaving us after many years here to take a position at the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields at the end of this school year.
At the Church of St. Martin in the Fields. Yeah, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields is a very famous orchestra, which
Neville Mariner conducting.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he's
I know, he's gone.
He's gone.
And yet he cannot, if you listen to music or something.
Yeah, no. Good. But St. Martin in the Fields is a church that's well known in London because it's an incubator of social movements. It's a place of imagination. It's a place of putting dreams into practice. And it's a very exciting opportunity to be invited to lead that institution because my life has been, a lot of it's been about trying to think creatively about poverty, but also in the context of beauty. And St. Martin's has a wonderful combination of both the musical and the artistic tradition, but also it has a large homeless ministry, and the house that I'll be living in has homeless people living on the ground floor. So it's a bringing together of different parts of my life.
Well, we like to think that Duke University brought you here because that is an important part of your life. You've done an enormous amount of good in the time that you've been here, and I will say that unequivocally. We will miss you deeply. And I will say that I have the bittersweet pleasure of being able to talk with you on April 17th at Duke to do what we're calling an exit interview. Sam has been doing lunchtime videos called The Dean's Dialogue, and the last of those will be on April 17th at Duke Chapel, 7:30. I'll be asking the questions this time and talking about your experience here, what you plan to do, and that is open to the public. We'll be happy to see people there. And Sam, thank you so much for all of your contributions here.
You've been very kind.
Sam Wells, Dean of Duke University Chapel, Research Professor of Christian Ethics at Duke Divinity School. Ruth Grant is a Professor of Political Science and Philosophy at Duke University, Senior Fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics. Katie Munger is a Durham-based mystery writer known for her books, the Casey Jones series and the Dead Detective series. She's got a new one coming out very soon. What's the title of your next book?
Angel of Darkness. It'll be out next month.
Angel of Darkness, and maybe we'll have you back. Katie, thank you so much, and thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.